Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the briefing. As you may be aware, today is marked by millions of people around the world as International Day Against Homophobia. This year, the United Nations High Human Rights Office, which is led within the United Nations system in relation to human rights protection for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, has put out a short, compelling video called The Riddle, which you can view on YouTube. In addition, the Secretary General has issued a message, which was delivered last night by the High Commissioner for Human Rights at a lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights conference in The Hague. We have copies of that message in my office. The High Commission will be delivering her own keynote speech on the issue at the closing session of the conference at 2 p.m. New York time today. Here to brief us on the issue of homophobia are Executive Director of UNAIDS, Michel Sidibé, and the Deputy Head of the New York Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Marit Kohonen Sharif. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I am proud to address you for International Day Against Homophobia. Over 30 years ago, the gay community lit the first spark that set off the AIDS response. Thanks to the audacity and courage of gays, lesbians, bisexual and transgender people, the AIDS response became a political movement. And since then, we have an extraordinary change happen. And we are seeing today progress against HIV all over the world. When we finally have the tool and resources to transform HIV into a chronic disease, when we have the possibility to talk about the end of the AIDS epidemic, I am outraged that we still have to fight prejudice, stigma, discrimination, exclusion, criminalization of gays, lesbian, and transgendered people, not only in their homes, but in streets, police stations, and courtrooms. This is impossible for me to understand and accept. As a matter of fact, it is unacceptable that only one in 10 gay men have access to life-saving HIV services. HIV prevalence amongst men who have sex with men is 19 times higher than in the general population. We also face an epidemic of bad homophobic laws. 78 countries still considering as a criminal offense to engage in sexual acts with someone of the same sex. In at least 7 countries, the death penalty still exists as a punishment for consensual same-sex acts between 2 adults. 30 years after the beginning of AIDS, the epidemic has come full circle. New HIV epidemic is growing among LGBT communities around the world. Homophobia and transphobia create barriers that are killing people. They deny equal rights and access to health services for everyone. If we are going to end AIDS, we need the LGBT community more than ever. But we need a different kind of activism, a new young generation of LGBT activists to create broad alliances for a social change. But you will not have to do it alone. Today, I am pleased to say that UNAIDS will continue to support worldwide advocacy to make sure that we will not continue to exclude people because of their sexual orientation or because of for what they are or who they love. We will make sure that we will accompany countries and education system to enable people to understand that when we are criminalizing people because their sexual orientation, they are hiding themselves, they are going underground, and they are just become a channel to infect their partners. We want also to say that UNAIDS will implement a new policy to extend the same-sex benefit to all UNAIDS staff. We are proud to walk the talk, and I am encouraged by the effort which is already being made by many countries to try to look at their own laws and policy, to reform them, and to make sure that people who are criminalized because their sexual orientation can have access to services. And I encourage also all employers across and beyond the UN system to make sure that they can have same-sex benefits to their staff. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Sharif.
Thank you. I join Michelle Sidibe, UNAIDS, the Secretary General of the United Nations, but also our High Commissioner for Human Rights today in celebrating 17 May as International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. It's not an official UN Day. It's not been declared an official UN Day by the General Assembly, and that in itself speaks volumes. It is an issue. The protection of human rights of LGBT people is something that divides nations, it divides people, and it's a very divisive discussion. But I submit to you that it's even more reason to speak about it, to use every opportunity to talk about it. We don't necessarily yet need to agree, but what we need to remind ourselves is that one of our most important goals is to turn the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and its core message, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights, into reality. We cannot promote and protect human rights if we don't include the rights of LGBT people in this struggle. So that in itself, I think, is a key message for today. Michelle Sidibe has really outlined quite eloquently already the massive discrimination, violence, abuse, threats, harassment, be it physical, moral, psychological, verbal, that LGBT people incur around the world. It's a global problem still. Just as it's a global concern, it's a global problem, and we need a global solution. And he also referred to the fact that in 78 countries, still laws, same-sex relationships are criminalized. So basically, people are turned criminals just because of whom they love. If you put it that way, it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable to anybody. Yet, it goes beyond the laws. We need first the political commitment of member states and of leaders, UN leaders and others. We need laws to change, but we also need institutions to change, and we need attitudes and perceptions to change. And that's probably the hardest part. And that's why it's so important that Noon Briefings and you, as our friends, as journalists, as sort of the multiplicators of the UN voice, join us in this fight to ensure that we reach a broader audience with our message, that we do share public human rights education, that people know what is at stake when we talk about discrimination and violence against LGBT people. And Eduardo already mentioned the riddle, the two-minute public service announcement on YouTube. Watch it. It's worth it. It doesn't take much of your time, but it's extremely powerful. And it shows you that it's a global problem. I want to close with one or two words of the Secretary General, which really marked me. He said that the laws that we face, that we need to change, are actually, we inherit 19th century prejudice that fuels 21st century hate currently. And that's, I think, a powerful statement. But also, human rights are for everybody. He said, not just for some or not for most, but for everybody. And regardless of our personal beliefs, we need to ensure that everybody who's born a human being is born equal in dignity and in rights. Happy to answer more questions. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Yes. On. Hello? It's on? All right. Thank you. Welcome. It's Pamela Falk, and on behalf of the UN Correspondents Association, we appreciate your being here to commemorate, even if it's unofficial, the International Day Against Homophobia. My question is, the Human Rights Council did pass a resolution, historic as it was, condemning violations based on sexual orientation and gender identity. How optimistic are you that it will be implemented? And if you're willing, where are the trouble spots? Thank you.
You wanted to take. Okay.
No, thank you.
It was historic at the Human Rights Council last year, and so as we're making history, I think that the wave is gaining momentum. There is a change. It was historic in many ways because the Council had never officially addressed this topic, never adopted a resolution, but also the co-sponsors of the resolution were across the continent, so it wasn't an exclusively Western resolution. So that's a key element, historical in that sense. It had a lot of opposition, not surprisingly, but the fact, and I say it again and again, including having worked in the field and cooperated with UNAIDS in many times, when we are able to engage our partners, the government, civil society, in dialogue on the issue, talk about it, that's already a huge step. In some countries, you cannot at all. So in those places where we can, and the Human Rights Council set the stage to say that this is something the international community needs to talk about, regardless of divisions. Now, from my understanding, there is potentially a movement now to move forward in the sense not only implementation of the resolution's provisions, which is changing decriminalization and so forth, but potentially even seeing how one could have dedicated human rights mechanisms that could address the issue. In the end, it might take time, but that's what human rights is all about. It's about perseverance and it's about commitment. Hotspots, you know, I can't name countries because it's a problem everywhere. And I mean, some of you will have seen today the EU Fundamental Rights Agency study that came out. It shows you 90% of 93,000 people polled in 27 countries of the EU plus Croatia do not report discrimination and harassment, yet 38% experience it. And this is in countries where maybe the laws don't even criminalize LGBT rights anymore. So we're a long way. And everybody, in a way, that's what should unite us. It is a common cause. We fight it at different levels. We might be at different stages in terms of popular acceptance, popular attitudes, political commitment, but it affects everybody in every country.
No? Matthew?
Yeah, sure. On behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access, thanks a lot for coming to do this. I wanted to ask about, there's even today, on this day, there was a group of priests in Georgia tried to break up a rally. They say a lot of people are injured. So I'm just wondering, maybe just as a matter of sort of getting a UN reaction to that. And I wanted to make sure, Mr. Sibidea, that I understood you correctly in terms of the treatment of UN staff. I know that once in a town hall meeting, the Secretary General was asked whether, in fact, for UN staff there are equal benefits for same-sex partners. And it seemed, at least at that time, the answer was not yes. Are you pushing it only for within UNAIDS or for system-wide? What's the status of the treatment of this issue within the UN itself? Thank you.
You can take the first part, but I want just to say that the issues for us is very simple, in the sense that we are not trying to really promote anything else than making sure that the protection of vulnerable could be at the center of our approach. When I said vulnerable, I'm talking about most at-risk population, people who are today excluded from the mainstream of our response because of their sexual orientation. And it's very difficult for us to see epidemic growing in a different part of the world, and our situation analysis is showing that most of the countries we are seeing men having sex with men with infection rate, like I was just mentioning, which is 19% higher than more, or 19 times more important than in normal population. But what is making also the issues even more complex, most of those people, because of the bad laws, because of the fact that they are criminalized, they are hiding themselves, but they are also sick. Can give you one example. You take countries where I was just visiting in Togo, 36% of the men having sex with men were HIV positive. But 65% of them were married or living on a stable relationship. So it's very clear that if those people are considered as a criminal and they have to hide themselves and they don't have protective laws which can give them access to services, and they will not just be a problem for them. It will not be a problem only for them, but for wives, the children which could be born HIV positive. So for us, that is a major, major, major challenge. We also realize that it will not be possible to change all those if in our own environment, like you just mentioned, UN setting, we continue to exclude and people who are in the same sex marriage to have access to the same benefit. So UNAIDS, it took us some time to really put in this policy out, and I can say that it took even almost 1 year trying to negotiate with our member state and other partners in our executive board to be able now to know that from probably next week, we'll be able to start to implement a new policy to extend same sex benefit to all UNAIDS staff. I hope it will help to bring the debate in other UN agencies. I hope it will bring also the debate globally. But it's very difficult for an organization like UNAIDS, who is trying to promote the protection of those vulnerable, to say that in the same organization we are discriminating them, we are denying them the right we are trying to claim the countries to implement.
Yeah, on Georgia, I wasn't aware of the case, but it is symbolic in the sense that every year before 17 May, we hear of many governments, including this year in Russia, prohibiting or not allowing for LGBT or human rights NGOs to get together and commemorate the day. And your question goes to the heart of the matter. It's not about LGBT rights in that context. It's about freedom of opinion, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, etc. So it goes much wider than that. On the issue of UN entitlements for UN staff, LGBT staff and their partners, certainly there are still issues to be addressed. And UN Globe, which is an association of staff, LGBT persons plus their supporters, is trying to negotiate these conditions, and OHHR works very closely with them. And I can't but agree with Michelle that we need to practice what we preach more than anything. Thank you.
Yes, as numerous countries exclude male homosexuals of like blood donation, organ donation, what is the position of UNAIDS on that issue?
So, sorry, I didn't get your...
Blood donation?
Huh?
Blood donation.
Blood donation.
Yeah. Male homosexuals are excluded from this issue.
You know, our position is very clear. We have been opposing to the fact that we should exclude the people, particularly gay people, from blood donation. We need today to be able to screen better, to make sure that we have all the mechanisms which will, at least the tools which will help us to know if we have a blood which is contaminated, we will not take it, and we can help the person to have access to services and make sure that the person could also be treated and have access to all the different. So, but still is very difficult. Like she was just saying, many of those policies were introduced when we were not knowing. Mm-hmm. You know, just to give you a good example, when I started to talk about ending of the discrimination of people, travel restriction, we were talking about almost 79 countries were refusing people to move freely from one place to another because of their HIV status. Today we are talking about 44 countries. So we have been able to reduce. So because those policies have been introduced when people were not knowing much about the epidemic. So we need to really continue to advocate to make sure that it could, every single year, I know that I'm writing, maybe that's why you're just asking the question. I'm writing to Margaret Chan to just say that, okay, let us see. I heard that this person has been, or people have been rejected from blood donation because this. So we are working on it.
George?
George Baumgarten, Nation Media Group, East Africa. They've asked me to cover any countries in Africa. Now, I can't possibly imagine that you tell me everything you know about 56 countries, but can you tell me, are there any
of the African countries with unusual situations in the field in their territory, or who have then taken unusual positions for or against LGBT rights in international fora such as the General Assembly?
Now, off the top of my head, very difficult, but for example, Malawi has recently decriminalized homosexual relations in their laws, taking quite a brave stand. Obviously, South Africa yes. has been for the long at the forefront of fight against or protection of rights of persons with LGBT, but with mixed successes, and some of these are very mixed successes. In the case of the countries I've recently served in the Central African countries, in Cameroon and areas around there, there is still decriminalization of same-sex relationship, and they take very strong stances at the General Assembly, but against the rights of LGBT persons.
When you say there is decriminalization, that means
criminalization. So there
okay.
is still.
In other words, they still regard it as
yeah,
a
and
crime.
Yeah, and in some countries, there's even a trend, I hate to say, of reinforcing the penalties for same-sex relationships. So instead of the trend going towards decriminalization, there are lobbies for strengthening the penalties that would be incurred, unfortunately, such is the case in Cameroon, Nigeria, and a few others.
Are there any countries where there it is still criminal, but there are active movements in the field to decriminalize?
Yeah, I would say in Uganda is a case in point. There is this long-pending bill before Parliament that has really shaken up civil society, has divided the nation, but there is an active civil society that is very much moving towards decriminalization.
Thank you. Young lady there?
Amy Lieberman with Women's E! News. There are some reports coming out of Mexico right now showing that there's been an increase in attacks on LGBT people there in the past year. And after talking with some attorneys here representing LGBT people, they've been telling me that there's also been an increase in the U.S. in asylum claims for transgender people from Mexico. So I'm wondering if that's consistent with what you've been finding in your office here, that there are more people from Mexico migrating because of discrimination against LGBT and transgender people in particular, and if that's a trend you're also seeing in different parts of the world.
I'm not aware of the specific case of Mexico. I can find out more. You can contact me after. However, yes, it is very often asylum seekers do also flee from persecution based on their sexual orientation and gender identity. And in some of those cases, obviously, we are then asked to provide information and so forth, whether we concur. Because in often cases, there are many grounds for persecution, and then the determination has to be then whether it is related to sexual orientation, gender identity, whether there are other factors involved, whether there are other human rights violations that might be at the core of it or linked to it and so forth. So it's clearly a trend, global trend, where in the case of Mexico, I can tell you.
Carla?
In many parts of the world, there seems to be a very reactionary trend regarding women's rights, including in this country, where now in some degree of jeopardy is freedom of choice. To what degree do you see there may be a correlation between the repression of women's rights and repression of LGBT rights?
But in the sense that the powerful, there is a tendency of the powerful, it's always easier to marginalize the vulnerable. So in that sense, one can speak of a correlation, women's rights, LGBT children, anybody who is in a situation of vulnerability, as already explained, who's not seen part of a mainstream, who's not in the majority, will be more easily discriminated, harassed, and abused. However, I wouldn't want to draw a parallel between women's rights and the discrimination against LGBT or draw a correlation, rather, between them, because I think that both battles have merits in their own right. They have very different origins and circumstances, apart from the fact that human rights violations are at the core of each. I also would like to say that in some countries, unfortunately, I have experienced that sometimes the women's rights movement has even lashed out against LGBT rights movement, in the sense to say that you are you're distorting the cause of the vulnerable, and you are shaking the definition of women's rights, and you are blending borders and so forth. So I've lived that, and it shocked me, because I think that if anything, women's rights movement could be very supportive to the LGBT rights movement, having done this for much longer.
I guess that's all the questions for today. I'm sorry, you have a question?
Is there any evidence, or has anybody found any information about the origins of bias, gender bias? Is it usually a cultural specific thing, or just an ancient tradition, or what would...
Of gender bias?
Yeah.
But normally the origins of it are in the social constructions of the relationship between women and men. So the way society sees that two genders relate to each other, and then behaviors, laws, processes, practices that develop over time. And of course, that's where LGBT issues become complicated, because not only are there already stereotypes attached to the social constructs that are male and female, but then when male and female traditional two genders are broken down and not relate to each other, but relate male and male, female, female, or transgender, bisexual, and so forth. So it's clear that social constructs are backlash, yeah, or are part of the bias that we're experiencing today.
Does it have anything to do with the British invasion of certain colonization? That's what I'm trying to ask you as well. Does it predate colonization, or does some of it come in with colonization depending on the...
I'm the first to say that these are... social construct relating to gender is something that exists inherently in any society where you have different genders. So that's whether colonial or non-colonial. However, some of the laws, as I said earlier, some of the laws that criminalize homosexuality currently, all of them date from colonial eras. Yeah. I mean, they are a colonial past, as the Secretary General said, that is now striving, or that is now driving our hatred. And we need to, just like in many other area of human rights, we need to get rid of these laws to open up the spirits and to move with the times.
Matthew?
Here in the UN, they have this the NGO committee, you know, they have the accreditation process, and often issues around gay rights, or at least it seems like there's a lot of, I've heard a lot of kind of prejudice statements made in that committee, and I wonder, what, particularly your office, do you monitor that? Is there some role for the UN, either secretariat or agencies, to play some role or set some limits on what's said? And also, if you can give some kind of an update on the Global Fund. I know we hear from Mr. Chambers of, like, this is the time of replenishing. Where does it stand?
Yeah. I think we are in a period where we are seeing progress, which is so important. We can say that a few years back, we were not even convinced that we could put so many people on treatment. Today, we have more than 8 million people on treatment. We are seeing decline on new infection. We are seeing hope that we can even stop the transmission from mother to child. And we are also seeing more and more change on science. Science is showing us that we could even start dreaming for cure. So the dream of ending AIDS, I don't say HIV, but ending AIDS, seeing people sick because HIV transmission, we can really start thinking about that. But that will not happen without also having resources to continue to sustain those progress. And that's why the replenishment of a global fund is critical. Replenishment of Global Fund will help us to certainly go beyond the just sustaining those programs which are producing results, but to even expand and reach those 8 million people who are waiting and don't have access to medicine today. But also is important, the issues we are talking about, the people we have been able to reach are the easy to reach. And now we can see in most of the places where epidemic is growing because we are not reaching those people most at risk, man having sex with man, people who inject drugs, or a sex worker. And if we don't change our laws and we don't change the way, the attitude and we are really dealing with those people. I think even if we mobilize more money, we will have a difficulty to reach those people.
On the NGO question, obviously those NGOs that seek accreditation through the Economic Social Council become sort of in consultative status. It's a member state-driven process. So there, it's not only LGBT that divides, but there are many other issues, country-specific issues, focus areas, where member states are not comfortable, and we continuously engage with that process now for many, many years, 20, 30 years, and depending on the tide of the time, the topic varies. That is the excluded topic. So we try. But I must admit that what is extremely important, and that goes to the human rights aspect of this, is that many mainstream human rights NGOs these days take on the LGBT cause. And that's different. That's important, because we used to have mainstream human rights NGOs working on civil political rights, yeah. Others then economic, social, cultural rights, a little bit neglected, and then marginalized groups, indigenous women doing their own thing. But what is important is that mainstream human rights NGOs that are well-known, organized, have lobbies and global networks also take on these causes, and then they assist the other organizations coming on board.
Last question, Pam.
Just a follow-up, thank you, on the unofficial status of the day of the International Day for Commemoration Against International Day Against Homophobia. Are you working on trying to get that passed? How do you see the progress? I know you have been, but do you see it as possible for the upcoming GA for any...
Not for the upcoming GA, but I think we need to, together. And the High Commissioner's statement that she's making today, it says that it is not yet. So yes. That is an indication of that we have the hope, we aspire to it. And what's interesting, in case you're the origin of the day, because I had to sort of inform myself as well, but it actually comes from the time from 1990, from WHO's decision to remove homosexuality from its list of mental disorders.
Yes.
So it's very interesting. It's not long, not long ago, and it will take some time, but I think, yes, that's what we should aim for sure.
I want to thank you very much for a very stimulating dialogue. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thank you very much for having us.
You're welcome.
Excuse me, if you could take your further questions outside, please. We're going to if you can take your further questions outside, we're going to continue with the briefing. Thank you so much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. The Secretary General recently finished a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Sochi. You will have seen that we issued a readout on that meeting, the main focus of which was Syria. The Secretary General expressed his support for the agreement between the Russian Federation and United States to convene an international conference as soon as possible to help the Syrian parties operationalize the 30th of June 2012 Geneva communique on establishing a transitional governing body with full executive powers. They discussed the importance of both regional support for the conference and the role of the Joint Special Representative Lakhdar Brahimi. They also discussed the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iran, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, climate change, sustainable development, and peacekeeping operations. Their conversation continued over a working lunch where they discussed the situation in the Korean Peninsula, Iran, the responsibility to protect, the Central African Republic, the Sahel and Mali, terrorism, and also Russia's presidency of the Group of 20. Earlier, the Secretary General met Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and held a press conference with him. The Secretary General told reporters that he sincerely hopes an international conference on Syria can be convened as soon as possible. Asked about allegations of the use of chemical weapons, he said it was regrettable that the UN investigation team has not been able to enter Syria to investigate on site. He again urged the Syrian authorities to be flexible and to allow the team to have on-site investigations. The full transcript of his press remarks are available online. The UN Refugee Agency says that the number of Syrian refugees who have now left their country has surpassed 1.5 million. The agency warns that the widening gap between the needs and the resources available is a growing challenge. UNHCR has registered close to 1 million refugees since January 1st of this year. That's about 250,000 people each month. Refugees have been described increased fighting and the changing of control of towns and villages, in particular in conflict areas, results in more and more civilians deciding to leave. Over the past 4 months, the refugee agency reports that it has seen a rapid deterioration when compared to the previous 20 months of the conflict. UNHCR continues to respond to the emergency needs of those in desperate need inside Syria and in neighboring countries. In a press statement issued last night, the members of the Security Council strongly condemned the incident on May 15th in which a group of anti-government armed elements detained three United Nations military observers from the UN Truce Supervision Organization's observer group Golan for several hours and looted a UN observation post within the area of separation there. In that incident, a group of unknown men, armed men, broke into UN Observation Post 52 in the area of separation. Three unarmed UN military observers were taken and held for approximately 5 hours and were released unharmed. They returned safely to UN Observation Post 52, where they were met by the UN Disengagement Observer Force head of mission. The members of the Security Council noted with grave concern that this was a third such incident in the past 2 months. Martin Kobler, the Secretary General's Special Representative for Iraq, urged all Iraqi leaders to do everything possible to protect Iraqi civilians as another wave of bombings hit the country during the past few days and claimed more innocent lives. He said that it is the responsibility of all leaders to stop the bloodshed in Iraq and to protect their citizens. He said that small children have been burnt alive in cars and worshippers cut down outside their own mosques. This is beyond acceptable, Mr. Kobler said. He said that it is a politician's responsibility to act immediately and to engage in dialogue to resolve the political impasse and put an end to this. The country will slide backwards if they do not take action. On Monday, the United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator will begin a 4-day visit to Sudan, which will take her to the capital, Khartoum, and to Darfur. While in the country, Valerie Amos will meet with government officials and representatives of aid organizations to discuss how to improve humanitarian access to people affected by conflict and displacement, particularly in South Kordofan, Blue Nile, and Darfur. In Darfur, Ms. Amos will see firsthand the ongoing relief operation 10 years after the start of the current emergency. The humanitarian community continues to work with the government to address deteriorating living conditions in camps and to find lasting solutions for those who have been uprooted for many years. The Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports that after making landfall in Bangladesh and moving away from Myanmar, Tropical Storm Mahasen has weakened and dissipated. Myanmar's Rakhine State was spared any impact from the storm, and initial assessments indicate no damage. The government reports that nearly 120,000 people were moved or relocated, and many are now returning to their camps or host communities voluntarily. UN agencies and their partners are continuing to monitor the movements of people to provide a sense of protection for all of those who are still displaced as the rainy season continues. In Bangladesh, the government says that up to 6 people were killed. While assessments are continuing, in spite of the damage anticipated, damage to houses has been limited. On Sunday, May 19th, the Deputy Secretary General will travel to Geneva to represent the Secretary General at the fourth session of the Global Platform for Disaster Risk Reduction. During his visit, he will participate and give opening and closing remarks at a high-level dialogue meeting on disaster risk reduction. He will also attend an event on Smile Island Developing States and Disaster Risk Reduction and meet with a group of mayors. On 22nd of May, the Deputy Secretary General will travel to The Hague, where he will have bilateral meetings with senior government officials. He will also meet with officials of the International Criminal Court and International Court of Justice. Then on May 26th, the Deputy Secretary General will travel to Brussels and represent the Secretary General at the third high-level meeting of the Inter-Regional Dialogue on Democracy. During his visit, he will hold bilateral meetings with European Union and Commission officials. He will also host a meeting with UN heads of agencies based in Brussels and participate in a discussion with members of the European Parliament. He will return to New York on May 29th. The UN Human Rights Office today welcomed the fact that dozens of international companies have made a legal commitment to improve safety in Bangladesh's garment factories in the wake of last month's building collapse, which the office says killed more than 1,100 people. Nearly 40 companies have signed on to the Accord on Fire and Building Safety, which the Human Rights Office calls an important and in many ways unprecedented agreement, which can be enforced in the countries where the multinationals are based. However, the office expressed concerns that some major retailers, especially in the United States, have chosen not to sign this agreement, but instead to carry out their own inspections. The office added that the best way to honor the victims of the recent collapse is to ensure that such a tragedy never happens again in any industry anywhere. Today, the Secretary General is announcing four senior personnel appointments. The first is that of Albert Gerard Bert Kenders of the Netherlands, who will serve as special representative for Mali and head of the UN Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in Mali, known as MINUSMA. Mr. Kenders has been the Secretary General's special representative and head of the UN operation in Côte d'Ivoire since October 2011. To fill Mr. Kenders' post in Côte d'Ivoire, the Secretary General is appointing Ms. Aishatou Mindaoudou Suleiman of Niger. Ms. Mindaoudou has been serving as Deputy Joint Special Representative in the African Union UN Hybrid Operation in Darfur. Haley Mancarius of South Africa will be the new head of the United Nations Office in the African Union and the Secretary General Special Representative to the African Union. Mr. Mancarius will also continue his current assignment as the Secretary General Special Envoy for Sudan and South Sudan. And finally, the Secretary General today announces the appointment of Lieutenant General Carlos Alberto dos Santos Cruz of Brazil as Force Commander of the UN Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Biographical notes on all these appointments are available in my office. And on Monday at 1:30, there will be a press conference here on the occasion of the opening of the 12th session of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. We have time for a few questions, please.
Thank you, Doug. Just to follow up, I asked a few days before whether the report that was given, that was sent to the Secretary General by the smaller Bosnian entity beside the report from High Representative Valentin Inzko was indeed received, and through what channel to the Secretary General's cabinet?
I'll have to check on that. I don't have any information on it.
You answered, I mean, Martin answered the same.
Well, I'm telling you exactly what I have, which I don't have anything. When we have something, we'll let you know, Errol.
If I only cannot, then the story sometimes cannot wait for it.
Well, you'll have to wait as long as it takes for me to get the information.
Thank
Nizar?
Yeah, Eduardo, they're, of course, talking about the refugee crisis of the Syrians, 1.5 million. There is compelling evidence, more and more reports coming, and even videos showing that the countries which are fueling the conflict there continue to do that outside the international legitimacy by sending weapons, by spending billions of dollars in order to militarize this conflict. Yesterday, there was a big truck crossing Turkey carrying French ambulances and French medical supplies, exploded at the crossing point in Bab el Hawa, causing a lot of casualties, death. It was, of course, disguised as humanitarian aid, but in fact there was a lot of munition inside and weapons, and they exploded there. Everybody was watching it. People suffered. What does the Secretary General think that he should tell these countries to stop fueling the conflict in Syria?
Nizar, we've been over this over and over again. As I've told you, the Secretary General from day one has said that militarization of this conflict is completely non-productive and unacceptable. He continues to stand by that position, which is why he is very anxious to have the second Geneva conference take place, so that a process of dialogue can hopefully begin and the violence come to an end. That's been his position for the past almost 3 years, and that continues to be his position. Matthew?
Sure. Some questions about Syria, but I want to be sure to get one in about Darfur before turning to that. There's the Jam rebels there say that Chadian troops have crossed the border into Sudan, and also that the Chadian Air Force has bombed their positions inside Darfur. Is that something that UNAMID is either can confirm or is trying to confirm?
I'll have to check with the mission.
Okay. Yeah, and on Syria, on this most recent seizure of peacekeepers. One, I wanted to know when did your office, the office of the spokesman, spokesperson of the Secretary General, become aware of this?
I'm not going to discuss that with you, Matthew. We had a statement that came out last night as a note to correspondents, and we'll leave it at that.
This seemed to come out this morning. That's why I'm asking you. There seemed to be a big gap between DPKO announcing it to a small group of journalists and your office, which is the official UN spokesperson's office, speaking about it. So I wanted to know what explains that gap.
Well, the fact is that it came out in a conversation that DPKO had with a few journalists, and afterwards we issued it as a note to correspondents. Carla?
Kidnapping of peacekeepers and
Carla?
I actually forgot what I was... Oh, yeah. There have been so many rumors about Mr. Brahimi. Is staying or leaving or whatever. Do you have any word?
The situation remains as it has been for some time. He made his statement very clear when he was here the last time, and that hasn't changed. Nizar?
On what basis did Mr. Lassou reveal information to certain journalists? How does he select these journalists and advise?
You have to ask DPKO, Mansour.
But I won't ask this question.
Masood, I'm sorry.
Continued Israeli attacks inside Syria, they're warning countries not to intervene while they're the aid being delivered to the militants. Has it been determined what militant groups Israeli is targeting for not supplying these weapons or whatever it is?
Well, we've seen...
Is it okay for them to continue to intervene like this?
Well, we've seen the reports. We've seen the reports, and obviously, this type of action is not acceptable under international law, and that's our position. That's where it remains.
Just
to
follow up on Carla's question regarding Mr. Brahimi, is it fair to say that after Secretary General meeting with the Russians, we have now the situation that Mr. Brahimi will prolong, or it's still fluid, as you said?
It's not fluid. Mr. Brahimi has been Joint Special Representative. He is Joint Special Representative, and as far as I know, he will continue to be Joint Special Representative.
Okay.
His situation hasn't changed. He made a statement here a few weeks ago, and that stands.
Okay.
One more question.
Sure. Okay, well, I guess I'll link these two together. Because first of all, I wanted you to confirm that Mr. Ladsou met with Syrian Permanent Representative Jafari, and I'd like to know... I have Mr. Jafari's readout on it. What's the DPKO's readout on it?
Matthew,
and if I can say this, it seems to me that the kidnapping or killing of peacekeepers shouldn't come out in a conversation by UN official, that your office has some duty to release news that's newsworthy to the correspondents, and on behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access, absolutely protested. It's sort of, how could you say in conversation? Would this be done on, if a peacekeeper died, would it be said in a conversation by USG, or does your office have some duty in this
regard? As I said in the statement, Matthew, they were held for a few hours and released. By the time we got word that they had been taken, they were released. Number two, we do not issue readouts as a normal situation on meetings between undersecretaries general and other people. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good weekend.